Well, as I get rolling tonight, want to welcome all of our YouTube folks out there. Got a bunch of questions, a couple from over last week, and then, boy, a flood of them came in this week. So let's jump into that here. The first one is in Genesis chapter 15, verse 16. And it says here, "But in the fourth generation they shall come hither again, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full." And the question has to do with what does this verse mean? What does it mean when it says the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full? And a key verse to this that really, you're going to find this in several places in the Bible. Come over to Daniel chapter 8. And if you don't have Daniel chapter 8 by verse 16, you need to put it in, and then a couple other places too. But come over to Daniel here, and this kind of gives you the best understanding of what that means, and then I'll broaden it a little bit for you. Daniel chapter 8, verse 23. And this verse here basically tells you what it means when you find the iniquity of the Amorites or someplace else is not full. Look at verse 23. "And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full." Now you see that? "A king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up." Now, obviously the context here is the tribulation. So it tells you here that when it's talking about something not yet being fulfilled or not being full, it's dealing with that nation's transgressions. And so when you get back here in Genesis 15, it says, "But in the fourth generation they shall come hither again, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full." What it means is as God deals with nations, he puts these nations on a timeline of him dealing with them or their wickedness and they're not doing what's right. So the Amorites here, what is not yet full is the fact that their transgressions hasn't come to the place yet where God is either ready, willing, or able to wipe them out and destroy them. So when you read that here in this particular verse in the context where the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full, it simply means that their transgressions against God hasn't reached the point yet where God says enough is enough. And then he comes down and he whacks them. So now you'll find a similar to this thing over here. Come over to Romans chapter 11. Here's a similar thing, but it isn't exactly it is the same thing, but it isn't the same thing. I'll show you in a minute here. Now look at verse 11, look at verse 25. It says, "For I would not, brethren, that you should be ignorant of this mystery, lest you should be wise in your own conceits, that blindness in part is happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles be come in, and so Israel shall be saved." Now there's another fullness represented here, but this is not dealing with wickedness. This is basically, again, God dealing with Gentiles, and obviously there is a what the old guys used to teach, and it's probably 100% true. I believe it. I wouldn't argue with somebody that didn't, but I believe it. We know that in Genesis chapter 6, we know that back in Ezekiel 28 and Isaiah 14, that when the devil revolted against Christ and God, that he took a third of the angels with him. Now those angels were sons of God. Now, one of the things about God that you want to always remember is that he is perfectly proportioned in everything that he does. He doesn't have any gaps. He doesn't have any blank spots. Everything runs in an order, and it runs with a precision, and there's no gaps in it. So technically speaking, when a third of the sons of God left with him, and you'll find this third number in Revelation chapter 12 and 13, where Satan's tail draws a third part of the stars, angels. So now heaven, technically, as far as the completeness of it, is incomplete. A third of the sons of God, I don't know what that number is. Nobody possibly could know. But now there's an absence of sons of gods. That has to be made up some way, somehow. God cannot just go through and finish out his plan with an incomplete part of it not fulfilled. So the old guys used to say, and I believe this is very true, the old guys used to say that, there's a number of reasons why God does the things that he does. And now that we have a blank spot here where we have a number of sons of God that are absent, remember now, sons of God are spiritual beings. It looks like that one of the reasons for the church age and the kingdom of God is that when you and I got saved, we became a son of God. And that, through soul winning, replaces the number that Satan took with him when he left heaven and took a third of the sons of God with him. So knowing God the way that I do and how he operates, I see the 100% value in that, because I'm telling you, God is a God that is an order God. He can't have any discrepancies in the order. And you may have a temporary discrepancy, like the devil, what he did, but it's got to be fixed before God can finish out what he's going to do. And so the church age would represent then the opportunity by winning people to Christ and then becoming sons of God. 1 John chapter 4:1, beloved, now are we the sons of God? 3:1. Well, now are we the sons of God? So that is replacing that number. Now, this almost sounds too good to be true, but it's probably based on the verse here, verse 20, 25, that when the last Gentile gets saved, that fulfills that number, that will trigger the rapture of the church. Now, everything you're seeing going on around us, what's going on in the Middle East, the time frame of where we're living, everything is pointing to, obviously, Christ's return and obviously the rapture. My point is this. God has all of that fitly put together, that it's all going to coincide exactly the way it should in the right time element with the fullness of the Gentiles coming in. And he's got that all worked out. It's all be planned. That would be nothing for him to orchestrate all those events to make that timeline right on the money. But so what he's saying here is that the fullness of the Gentiles come in is going to be the thing that triggers, look at verse 26, and so shall all Israel be saved, as it is written, there shall come out of Zion a deliverer and shall turn away the ungodliness of Jacob. So what you're seeing here is that once the rapture takes place, immediately we know the tribulation takes place, and then immediately we have the second coming of Christ. That'll be 26. That'll be the out of Zion. That's spiritual Mount Zion and Mount Sinai on earth. He's coming out of there in the second coming, and Israel goes into the millennium. Verse 27, this is my covenant unto them. This will be the new covenant that you find in Hebrews chapter 8. Also, I think it's referenced in Jeremiah a couple of places where he's given them the new covenant. So it all hinges on the fullness of the Gentiles. So What I want you to understand is when you find this term, it means something now has come full circle and is complete. When he says the times of the Amorites is not yet fulfilled, he's talking about God is not ready to destroy them yet because their transgression isn't to the point where he says, okay, that's it. But when you get into Romans 11, the fullness of the Gentiles signifies something else. But in both cases, it's something now is complete. And then God acts on that completeness, whether it's with the Amorites or it's with the Gentiles coming in. So that's a great question, and it's something that you want to understand how it works, because you're going to find that in the Bible, in particularly those two places. And, the idea that heaven is incomplete, and so us winning people to Christ and making sons of God out of them through the new birth is filling that number. It's amazing, because how would you like to be the last Christian on earth who won the last person to Christ that was the last one to fill the number and triggered the rapture of the church? That would be cool. So anyway, that's what you got with that question, and that is a really good question. So, the next question here kind of goes, all these kind of fit in here tonight. This came off the website. One of our faithful followers asked me the question: do you think the Antichrist, when he shows up, will look like our picture of Jesus as we see and as we know him? Or will he look like Judas, which both Judas and the Antichrist are called the son of perdition? So his question is, do I think that the Antichrist, when he shows up, will look like every picture that we see of Jesus, which is a Roman Catholic presentation, by the way, where he's got the flowing brown hair. He looked like a European. And of course, that picture came out of Europe. Back in the Middle Ages, through the Catholic Church, they've always propagated that as his image. And I would say, and again, I'm not dogmatic about this, knowing how the devil operates and how he works the crowd, so to speak, I would say that it would probably be that he looked an awful lot like that picture. Most of you know about the Shroud of Turin, whatever it is. And it's supposed to be the body cloth that when Christ died, they laid over his body, and his facial and his body got superimposed upon the shroud. And they found this thing at some point, and actually, no question about it, it's got an imprintation of a guy's body. His face is fairly detailed, and then the rest of his body. And the Catholic Church claims that this is the burial shroud called the Shroud of Turin, which was on Christ. Now, obviously, it wasn't. There's no question about that. But what you want to look at is, if you look at that shroud, the facial features are just like the Roman Catholic rendition of Christ. Bearded, narrow face, just like you see in the pictures that are the Roman Catholic rendition. Now, the closest that you're going to get to what Christ really looked like will obviously be in the book of Song of Solomon, and where the bride describes him. Doesn't give all the details, but gives enough of the details, you know, that it certainly isn't the one that the Roman Catholic Church put out where he looks like Errol Flynn. It's different than that. And the Bible in the book of Ecclesiastes talks about him, his hair being black and bushy. It talks about his complexion being ruddy, which is kind of a reddish brown. He's a Jew. But it has nothing to do with the Roman Catholic rendition. One of the things that I've learned about the devil and how he operates, and this is something that's very important that you never want to forget, he always He'll put out an idea, and then he'll foster that idea for literally decades, sometimes hundreds of years. And what happens is that false idea in time permeates and saturates the unsaved world's mind, and unfortunately many of God's people's minds, that they actually think that this is what it really is, and it isn't. And of course, Christ's picture that you see, and again, as I said, comes out of the Roman Catholic Church, where he's portrayed as a European with the long flowing brown hair, the beard, and all those things. You see him that portrayed in that aspect. Even in some of the Christian aspects for little children's books, it'll do the same thing. And what it does is, that it, in time, people actually think that this is what he really looked like. This is why, in the Old Testament, they were not allowed to have pictures on the wall. They were not allowed to put the pictures of anything up on the wall, because what happens is you tend to worship that. Years ago, when I was a youth pastor, I had a kid that got in trouble and had to take him home to his parents. And his parents were good Christian people, no question about it. They really were. So we get in the front door, and we're in the little vestibule there, and mom and dad come down, and the kid here, you know, and I said, hey, look, this is what he did. I had to go get him. You know, I'm just bringing him home. You guys are going to have to deal with it, da-da-da-da-da. And there were, on the wall there was their picture, had a picture of Jesus, okay? Typical picture of Jesus that, you know, Roman Catholic version. I just told him, I said, this is what we've got, you know, and she gets very emotional, and she looks over at the picture and she says, oh, Jesus, what am I going to do? And right then, this is my point. This is what happens. Now, I know that she's a good woman. I know that she's saved, and I know that she's dead now. I know she's in heaven. But I bet now she understands the picture, but that's another story. But I thought to myself, that's exactly what happens. Because we as human natures, we always have to associate with something that we see. There is a reason why God never gave us a real clear rendition of what he looked like. And the answer why he didn't is very simple by the story I just told you. Because we would make pictures of that and put them on our wall, and then we would start worshiping in that picture. That's what we would do. So when it comes to what he looked like, it's a mystery. And personally, I do believe how the devil will always put something out there, and he'll float it for decades, a couple of hundred years. Everybody gets saturated with it, and that's what they think. So if you were the devil and you have spent 1,000 years giving people a picture of a false Jesus of what he looks like, and everybody now believes that, how would you show up when you came? And of course, that's exactly most likely what he'll do. Maybe not exactly like that, but enough that everybody will, people are so stupid today that they will associate the Antichrist with what they have been taught and brainwashed that Jesus is, and that'll just be part of the deception. I don't know if you know it right now, and you can see it across this country, actually across the world. We are so close to everything falling apart and coming into a real disaster here that's going to usher in, you know, the second coming, obviously the rapture. This world, especially this country, is so far away from any Bible truth that they have lost any semblance of anything that is really truth in the Bible. It's what I've been telling you on Sunday morning. The closer we get to the end, the farther we get to the truth. What the devil is actually doing, he's flaunting in the face of everybody in America and everybody in the world exactly the things that are going to be happening in the tribulation period. He's laying it out right now in front of everybody, but because everybody has no Bible and has no truth, they laugh at it or they take it in stride and they think it's just part of something out here, when actually the devil is flaunting the very things he's going to do in the next, I used to say couple of years, I'm not sure I can actually say that anymore, probably in the next hour or so. And he's flaunting it in front of everybody's face right now. I mean, did you see the Olympics when they had the horse rider from Revelation? Right in front of everybody. Nobody got it. You got Elon Musk who keeps telling everybody, I keep telling you I am an alien. Everybody just laughs at it. You got everything he's flaunting in front of people, but because there's no Bible, no truth, it's what he always does. So I would say probably yes, to some degree of accuracy, when the Antichrist shows up, he would definitely continue. I mean, he didn't have the Roman Catholic Church come up with that rendition of who the world thinks Christ is, just because, oh yeah, there's always a reason to everything that he does, just like there's a reason to everything that God does. So what would be the point of doing that if he wasn't going to use that? And I'm telling you, in the world we live in today, everybody will think that's what Jesus looks like and that's who he is. And I've always told you, like I told you last Sunday, one of the things you want to look for with the devil is before the real one shows up, the counterfeit always shows up. That is a rule you can take to the bank. Before the real millennial kingdom shows up, the false kingdom is going to show up. Before the real Christ shows up, the Antichrist is going to show up. It's just the way that he operates. And it's a thing where, so I would say yes, to some degree of certainty, he probably will. It would only make sense after he spent, 1,500 years developing that mindset. Every picture you have ever seen of Jesus portrayed in a bookstore, a Christian junk store that sells all the Christian paraphernalia, wherever you would get kids' Bibles, pictures, whatever you see. There he is right up there. See, you can see him right up there. That's him knocking on the door. And that's the Roman Catholic rendition right there. And so I would say that probably, yes, he does. Exactly how much accuracy it is to it, I don't know. The kicker for me was when I saw the Shroud of Turin. You know, the first, and it's been out for a long time. And, you know, when I first saw a picture of it, and they claimed it to be the death robe of Christ, that they covered him up, and then it got superimposed on it. You know, and here it is today. The moment I saw it, I thought to myself, that's exactly you can see by his facial, that's exactly what the European Catholic Church has portrayed him as. So, and the Shroud of Turin is as phony as a $3 bill. So, you know, that's what you got. So to answer your question, probably most likely, I would say yes. Let's see here. Now this next one here is in Job 42. This is a good one. Now, Job chapter 42 is where God turns the captivity of Job. And he is no longer persecuted, or he's no longer, you know, going through all the things that he's going through. And in verse 10, it says, And the Lord turned the captivity of Job when he prayed for his friends. Also the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. Then came there unto him all his brethren and all his sisters and all they that had been of his acquaintance before, and did eat bread with him in his house. And he bemoaned him and comforted him over all the evil that the Lord had brought upon him. Every man also gave him a piece of money, and every one an earring of gold. So the Lord blessed the latter end of Job more than the beginning, for he had 14,000 sheep and 6,000 camels, 1,000 yoke of oxen, and 1,000 she-asses. And he also and had also 7 sons and 3 daughters. And he called the name of the first Jemima, and the name of the second Kiza, and the name of the third Karan, however punch or whatever. And in all the land were no women found so fair as the daughters of Job, and their fathers gave them inheritances among the brethren. Now the question is, Job had just went through a terrible time for 7 days, and we know that he lost everything. And the question is that we know that Job's kids were killed early on in the book of Job when the devil brought a great wind and the house collapsed and everybody was dead. And now we find at the end of the book, we find these kids, 7 sons and 3 daughters again. The question comes up is, was these kids resurrected, or did Job have more kids? Now, and the question thrown in there that, you know, in Peter Ruckman's book on Job, he likens and gives you the whole picture of here that you have to kind of understand to see which way this goes. First of all, we know that the book of Job, Job is a type of the nation of Israel. And Job is attacked by the devil for 7 days, just as Israel will be attacked by the devil for 7 years in the tribulation. So the book of Job is a picture of the tribulation period. We know that the tribulation runs 7 years. But the first half of it, 42 months, is a relative time of peace and safety. It's the last 42 months that is called the Great Tribulation. This is where the nation of Israel is attacked and tried to be wiped out by the Antichrist and basically the whole world. So it's the last 42 months that picture Israel's real tribulation. And if you'll notice that the book of Job has 42 chapters in it, those 42 chapters will match up to the 42 months of the last half of the tribulation that he goes through. Job is on the ground in the land of Uz. That's where the Jews are going to be in the tribulation period. And if you notice over here, and here's where you got to really start paying attention. In verse 10, it says, "And the Lord turned the captivity of Job when he prayed for his friends, and the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before." Now, you're going to find that in Isaiah chapter 61, verse 7, that's exactly what the Lord does with Israel at the second coming of Christ. So you're going to see that there's some real close stuff here that you got to take into consideration and that you've got to look at. And Job gets the captivity turned in the 42nd chapter. Israel gets the captivity turned in the 42nd month. You just can't get away from that. After you look at everything that he loses, just like Israel loses everything, in the 42nd chapter, matching the 42nd month, you start to see all the things in the Bible come back into play. And when you look at verse 11, it says, "Then came unto him all his brethren and all his sisters and all they that had been of his acquaintance before, and they did eat bread with him in his house, and he bemoaned him and comforted him." Now, I understand that historically all of his acquaintances came and they had a party and ate. But at the same time, you're going to find that when the Lord comes back in Revelation chapter 19, verse 9, that there is a banquet, and the whole family of God, which would be his brethren doctrinally, are at this banquet. So everything here is very close to actually being a doctrinal truth, even though historically it actually happened. There's a doctrinal significance to it that you can't get away from. Now, look at verse 12. So the Lord blessed the latter end of Job. Now, that's a key word. If you don't have that marked in your Bible, you need to mark that in there, because that is a clear reference to the second coming of Christ, because we know that it comes in with the former and the what? Latter reign. So the latter time has to do with that latter reign. So everything here is second coming, and everything Israel typified by Job is getting. Now, verse 13 says he had also seven sons and three daughters. Now, the question is, were these kids resurrected from the ones that were killed, or did he have ten more kids? Well, personally, and I wouldn't be dogmatic about this, and I wouldn't argue and fight over somebody who didn't accept this. Personally, I believe that they were resurrected. And somebody would say, why do you believe that? Well, first of all, seven sons and ten daughters, the time element is too short for him to have ten kids. I mean, so common sense would tell me that they were resurrected, because there's not enough time here to have seven conceptions and seven births. 9 months apart. You do the math. The time frame doesn't match up to that. I wouldn't argue with somebody that wanted to believe that, because it's a thing that it doesn't matter one way or the other, as long as somebody understands the doctrinal impact of it as you do the rest of it. If somebody said, well, I just can't, I don't think they were resurrected, I believe that they had 10 more kids, well, you know, have at it. I'm good with that. It's okay. Personally, I think that the way it's stated in verse 13, and you're going to find in the Bible almost every time there is a birth, I can't think of an exception to this, except one, and that's a dark cloud and a real key. But every time you find a birth in the Bible, there's always a conception connected with it in the same text. So I would say, based on just putting everything together, that, yeah, these kids were probably resurrected. Because, as you know, at the end of the second coming, there is a resurrection. And it's a resurrection of the dead. So I would say that, keeping in tune with the story as the second coming, and everything as closely as it's sliced here, from the double portion to the captivity turn to the resurrection, I would say probably yes. But again, there's no absolute dogmatic way that you could prove that. So it's one of those things where, you know, you have to look at the evidence you have, and then you have to make up your own mind. But even though I believe that they were resurrected, I wouldn't argue with somebody. If somebody said, well, Bob, I don't think that's the way it happened, I'd say, okay, no problem. It's no big deal. But I think, given the information that you have, it only leads you with one conclusion. But whatever, we're all good with it. So, but that's another really good question. Now, this is a quick one. It came in off the deal. You don't even have to turn to this one. In John chapter 10, verse 34, the question is, it is written, that he says in the law, that it is not, is it not written in the law that ye are gods? And of course, that's what it says in John 10, verse 34. The question is that he looked back through the Old Testament, and the only place that he could find a reference to this was in Psalms 82, 6. And so his question was, is Psalms 82, 6 the right reference, or should he look back farther? No, Psalms 82, 6 is the only reference you're going to get. Now, I understand what you're thinking, because he used the word the law. But here's what you got to look at. In a general sense, everything in the Old Testament is considered the law. So it's you're thinking the first, you know, the Ten Commandments being the law, or Leviticus being the law. That is all true. But the whole Old Testament is considered the law. In fact, the Bible tells you that the law and the prophets were under John the Baptist. That tells you that the law was in effect more than just the first five books of the Bible. So you're absolutely right. Psalms 82:6 is your reference. And don't get hung up by it because it says in the law, because the whole Old Testament was considered, is considered under the law. So good job on finding that out, okay? Now, the next one here is going to take a little time here, which is good. And this came in from one of our guys here in the thing. And at work, he got into a discussion. In fact, I talked to him tonight. He's working security. And I got a little more detail. He was talking to a guy about the Lord. And then he says, out of nowhere, this guy come busting into the conversation and started talking about covenant theology. And he wanted to know, my guy wanted to know what covenant theology is, and could I give him any light on how to be able to, you know, if you get into a discussion with somebody that believes in covenant theology, so you basically know what you're talking about. So, yeah, sure, absolutely. Now, let me start by giving you the historical foundation for covenant theology. And of course, the covenant theology has never been associated with Bible believers in any way, shape, or form. Covenant theology starts with John Calvin in the Reformation, guys like Calvin, Zwingli, and it has its basic strength or foundation in the Presbyterian Church. They all follow a covenant theology. Now, over the years, covenant theology, they have adjusted it a little bit from time to time because they were getting their rear ends kicked by too many Bible believers on positions they couldn't, so they had to develop it. But first off, you know, covenant theology starts with the Reformation, with the Presbyterian Church. It's also tied in to Calvinism with the predestination crowd, which is predominantly the Presbyterian Church. Now, I know that there's other variations of, you're going to find in the neo-evangelical world, the people that take Baptist off their names. Some of the men who you would follow on the radio, like John MacArthur, men that were at one time really good, solid, kind of really good, solid Bible teachers or preachers, they all have went to, got into Calvinism. And you're going to find that it is pretty rampant now throughout the, again, it goes back to what I said, the closer we get to the end, the farther we get from the truth. And so you're going to find that all these, not all these, but many of these neo-evangelical churches that were once Baptist churches, and many of these guys have now embraced Calvinism. And when they got kicked around too much because it was connected to John Calvin, then they changed the name of it to what now you hear most of the time is Reformation theology. And Reformation theology was another term that they named it to get away from Calvin. But you can't get away from history any way you go, because if it's Calvinism, then it started with Calvin. If you don't want to believe that, and you want to get away from Calvin, and you call it Reformation theology, all you've done is literally went across 6 inches to the left, because now it started with the Reformation. The bottom line is Calvinism as covenant theology is not found any place in history before the Reformation. So the first thing you want to know about covenant theology is it's connected to Calvinism, and neither one of them have anything to do with anything seriously with the Bible. You couldn't find in the Bible-believing groups that go back through the church age, the Albigensians, the Waldensians, the Bugamiles, all of those crowds, none of them, there isn't anybody on planet Earth who followed the aspect of predestination before Calvin, other than the Roman Catholic Church had their brand of it. But no Bible believer had it. So when Calvin and these guys, and you got to understand Calvin, John Calvin, and personally, from reading his works, I have a hard time believing that John Calvin was saved. I know he's counted as one of the reformers. I get that, as is Martin Luther. I believe Martin Luther was saved. I have a hard time believing John Calvin was saved when you read some of the things that he writes. And the difference between Calvin and Luther had a disdain for the Catholic Church because he had a longing to find Christ. And I have told you the story before how he found it by reading the book of Romans, The Just Shall Live by Faith. And then when he got saved, even though he kept some of the stuff, he was truly saved and broke with the Roman Catholic Church. And for a period of time, the Lutheran Church was much more fundamental than the Catholic Church, and then time, it slides back into the mess. Calvin's approach was different. Calvin wanted to start the Presbyterian Church, and he wanted to set himself up as, I'm going to use the word for lack of a better, he wanted to set himself up as the leader and the Pope of the Presbyterian Church, just as the Pope had set himself up in the Catholic Church. Calvin's motive was he persecuted Bible believers. He never believed in the second coming, literal second coming of Christ, a day in his life. He broke with the Roman Catholic Church, even though he was never officially part of it, but he took a stand against it, only to start his own church. And the Presbyterian Church then becomes big in Scotland, in England, and then later on as it comes into the United States, and it breaks off into a bunch of different little fragments. But it was Calvin who originally came up with the idea of a covenant theology. Now let me explain covenant theology to you. We are dispensationalists. I've taught you the 11 or 12 dispensations that the Bible is built around. The standard definition for a dispensation is that it is a period of time. That's not exactly accurate, though. A dispensation will be a period of time, but a more accurate rendition of a dispensation that it may be a period of time, but it's a period of time where God is doing one thing this way that he's going to change when he gets into the next dispensation. The greatest example of that would be before Genesis or Exodus 12, where you had God dealing with Gentiles through their conscience, and then you have the dispensation of the law. And then we would have the dispensation of grace, which we are in now, which is different. And those are just two bigger understandings of what a dispensation is. Certainly, they're a period of time, but they are a period of time where God is doing something. And God will change in that period of time from one to the other. It isn't that the period of time changes because this is another dispensation. It's another dispensation because God changes within that time what he's doing or how he's doing it. So we as Bible believers are dispensationalists. We believe that the Bible is broken down in God's 11 dispensations or 12, depending on how you count them. It's no big deal. Covenant theology is not based on dispensations. Covenant theology is based on the covenants that God makes with man down through the Bible. And I'll lay those out for you. Here's where the covenant people get really screwed up. Not only do they build the Bible around these seven covenants, Calvin originally in his covenant theology believed that you had to believe in Christ in the New Testament, but you still were accountable under the law in the Old Testament. So it was kind of like a system, much like the Presbyterian Church is today, certainly the Lutheran Church, and most certainly the Catholic Church is. It's a system of New Testament and Old Testament kind of being blended together that produces a salvation. Now in your Bible, there actually are eight covenants, but the covenant theology crowd are so stupid when it comes to the Bible and reject so much of it that they can't figure that out. But let me give you the ones that they follow. The first covenant in your Bible that is a legitimate covenant will be what they call the Edenic covenant. That is the Garden of Eden covenant. And this was given to Adam and Eve in the garden. And this covenant lasts up till the fall. Not the fall in September, but the fall of man. The second one is the Adamic covenant. And this is the covenant that God made with Adam and Eve after the fall. This will be in Genesis 9, up to Genesis 9. The third one will be the Noah covenant. And that'll be made with Noah after the flood. That'll be Genesis 9, The fourth one will be the Abrahamic covenant, and this one you find in Genesis 12, 1 through 3, given to Abraham and his calling out for the future of Israel. The fifth one will be the Mosaic covenant, and this is the one that is given to Moses on Mount Sinai in Exodus chapter 20 when he gets the law. The sixth one will be the Davidic covenant given to David and his house in 2 Samuel chapter 7, verses 4 through 17 by Nathan the prophet. Now, the covenant theology builds their Bible around these six. And then they add the seventh. And the seventh is what they call, and in the Bible is called, the New Covenant. Now here's where they get messed up. The New Covenant, they want to make the church age. And they think that Christians in the church age are also under a covenant. Now, once you do that, then you can see how they connect the covenants together, a system of grace under a system of works is all the covenants working together, because the Old Testament covenants are certainly a system of works. So now you see how that they try to put that together. And this is where they make the mistake. Now, let me give it to you the way that it really is biblically laid out. Eden covenant, the Adam covenant, Noah covenant, Abraham, Mosaic, and the David covenant is all 100% correct. The one that they missed would be the number seventh one, and that is the Palestinian covenant, or the covenant given to the restoration of the nation of Israel. And this will be found in places like Deuteronomy chapter 31 through 10, where God now is calling back of Israel in our time period, 1888 to 1948, when they become a nation. And this will be the covenant that he makes on the restoration of the nation of Israel. They don't even get that one. I'll tell you why in a moment. Now, in the Bible, there is a new covenant. You'll find that new covenant, and I want to look at it here. Come over to Jeremiah chapter 31. I want to show you how this thing, how they tear this thing apart. Now look at verse 31. Now this does not get any clearer than clear. How somebody could not see this for what it is and try to put this in the church age, there's only one answer to it, and I'm going to give you that answer here in just a moment. Look at verse 31 of Jeremiah 31. Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will make a new covenant. If you don't have this passage marked in your Bible, you need to do that. Make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. Now, how much clearer can it be that he's talking to the nation of Israel here and to the house of Judah? Notice at this time, the nation of Israel is divided. It's divided into two southern tribes, which is Judah, and the 10 northern tribes, which is Israel. So he's clearly addressing both segments of this. Not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand out of the land of Egypt. That's the Mosaic covenant, see? So now you see that he's making a parallel. I just don't know how you would get anything out of this other than what is clearly right there in front of you. He's make the comparison of the old covenant with Moses to Israel, and then he's telling them that he's going to give Israel and Judah a new covenant. How on God's green earth would you read of the old covenant to Israel, and when he says he's making a new covenant, you make that the church? How in the world do you do that? I'm going to tell you how you do that in just a minute. Not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, which my covenant they break, although I was a husband unto them. But this shall be a covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days. There's another key, isn't it? After those days always is a reference to the tribulation period. So this covenant is going to take place after the tribulation. How in the world could you make this the church age? I'm going to tell you in just a minute. Maybe. But this shall be the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, saith the Lord. I will put my laws in their inward parts and write their hearts, and there will be their God, and they shall be my people. Now see, the reason why they make this the church is because when you get rid of the true meaning of the new covenant and you make it to the church, then you can go back to the Mosaic covenant and put them all together, because they still teach, even though you're under grace, you're still under the old covenant. See how it works? And nothing could be farther from the truth. Now, you're going to find also when you get over to Hebrews chapter 8, let's go over there real quick. Look at Hebrews chapter 8, verse 8. Let's pick it up in verse 6. But now hath he obtained a more excellent ministry, by how much also he is the mediator of a better covenant. See that? Which was established on better promises. For if that the first covenant had been faultless, there should be no place have been sought for the second. For finding fault with them, he saith, Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. There it is again. Not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day when I took them. There it is, exactly like I just gave you back in Jeremiah. Now here's the problem. They don't see the new covenant as being to the nation of Israel. The reason, and they so they put it to the church. The reason why they don't see it as a covenant to Israel, the new covenant, after the old covenant failing, and the new covenant being the millennium, is because Calvin, the Presbyterian Church, and any covenant guy on planet Earth rejects the visible return of the second coming of Christ. He's amillennial. He does not believe in the premillennial return of Christ. Calvin didn't believe it. Covenant theology doesn't believe it. Nobody believed it. So when they miss that truth by taking the wrong approach at the second coming of Christ, they miss all the key verses that talk about the new covenant. And the new covenant will be Israel in the millennial reign of Christ, which gets the new covenant that now is establishing them in the land based on the one that Moses had that they failed in. So you have a total of eight covenants that your Bible is built around if you are a Bible believer. You have the Edenic covenant, you have the Adamic, the Noah, Abraham, the Mosaic, Moses, then you have David's, and then you have the regathering of Israel with the Palestinian covenant, restoration of Israel. And then the one coming up after the tribulation, after those days. You see, when you reject the King James 6 and 11 authorized version, which these guys do, when you throw out the Bible as the final authority, and you're already a member of a non-biblical organization that has nothing to do with biblical truth, never has and never will. You can get things in the Bible and you can make whatever you want to make out of them, but you'll never get any Bible truth because you reject the key words in the Bible. And the key words in the Bible are what keeps the context for you. The reason I know that the new covenant is not anything to do with the church, first of all, there's no covenant for the church, is the fact that it says after those days, which puts it after the tribulation period. But if you don't have a Bible or you don't believe your Bible and you don't know the key words in the Bible and you're already an amillennialist, well then you're done. You ain't going to get anything out of it. So covenant theology has never been a Bible believing organization in any way, shape or form. It's never been associated with any Bible truth, any Bible-believing group. It starts out of the Reformation with Calvin, predestination, and a theology based on the covenants. And he built his Bible teaching around the covenants. We build ours around the dispensations. When you build it around the covenants and you don't believe the Bible, you miss the covenant for the regathering of Israel, and you certainly get screwed up on the new covenant. And so what do? Because they put all these covenants together, and they think the church is the new covenant, then they put all those covenants together, and then they will teach you, even though you're in the church, you're still under the law. See how it works? Yeah.
So is this where a replacement...
Who's got the mic? Hang on, honey. We're going to put you on the air, live stream you.
So is this where they come up with the replacement theology?
I'm sorry.
Replacement theology. since
covenant theology? Yeah.
Replacement theology, that they've replaced Israel, since they don't see that that's Israel?
No, no. They don't believe, they believe that, they follow, basically, amillennialism cuts Israel out of everything. The Catholic Church is all millennial. All of the Protestant churches that came out of the Catholic Church in the Reformation are all millennial. The Catholic Church is the greatest example of what all these other people believe. They believe that when the Jews made their final rejection and crucified Christ, that God was finished with the Jew. They now believe that the Catholic Church has taken the place of the Jew. This is where the original predestination concept came in. Calvin's favorite theologian was Augustine. Augustine was probably, I'm going to use the word greatest, not greatest because he was good, greatest because he was popular. Augustine was the greatest theologian the Catholic Church probably ever had from their standpoint. He wrote a book which is called City of Our God. This is back in 400 AD, right after the time of Constantine, when the Catholic Church is beginning to blossom. In that book, he teaches that the Catholic Church, now after the Jews killed Christ, that the Catholic Church is now predestined to be in the place of the nation of Israel. When Calvin, who loved Origen, read his material and books, it's where he got the idea of predestination, of somebody being predestined. But originally it was the Catholic Church being predestined by God to take the place of the nation of Israel. Once that happens, Israel is out. In fact, it wasn't until Vatican II, which took place, I think, in the 60s, it wasn't until Vatican II that the Catholic Church forgave Israel for killing the Messiah. Up to that point, they were called Christ killers. This is why the Catholic Church persecuted the Jews so terribly through the Dark Ages. And I don't care what Vatican II says, they hate them today just as much as they ever did. It was a political move, believe me. But amillennialism has at its base source that whoever believes that has taken the place of the Jew, no matter what they tell you, because they do not believe in the visible return, the literal return of Christ. Well, what is the literal return of Christ all about? It's to restore the nation of Israel. You get rid of that, you get rid of the Jew. So all of these Protestant groups that came out of the Catholic Church, either directly or indirectly, they all followed that line of reasoning. So, you know, that's what you're dealing with, and, you know, that's what you've got. Covenant theology, as I said, it's never been connected in any way, shape, or form with Bible believers in any way. It didn't come out to the Reformation. It came out with a man who probably was not saved, Calvin. And, I mean, you read what he wrote, and on top of that, how in the world could any man truly be born again? And your favorite theologian that you built your ministry on is Augustine. Are you kidding me? And it's a thing where, but this is what they don't care about. They don't tell you that because everybody has their hidden agenda. And the covenant guys want to build the Bible around a covenant. The Bible-believing guys will build it around dispensations. Because if you look at all the covenants, let me say this, to be clear, the eight covenants I've given you are found in the dispensations. There's no question about that. But they'd throw out the dispensations and just build the Bible around the covenant. And the reason they want to do that is because they want to make the church age the new covenant instead of Israel, because they reject Israel and they think they have taken the place of Israel. So Israel gets cut out of the covenant, they get no millennium, they get nothing, and now they can put that new covenant with the church in the line of covenants in the Old Testament, and then they can keep the idea of faith and works coming together. On top of that, the Presbyterian Church as Calvin did, as the Catholic Church, as the Lutheran Church, and as the covenant guys, they all believe salvation is through baptism. So there you have it. That's covenant theology. And like I said, there's different variations of it. There's actually, and like I said, there's actually now out what they call a new covenant theology that they try to make up some of the horrendous differences, but it's all the same deal. And you're going to find that heresy, and this is another thing you want to look for. Heresy always has one common thread that runs through whatever heresy that you're going to find. They always have to repackage it in time. You have the Mormons, and now you have the reorganized Latter-day Saints. They had to repackage it. You have the Charismatics, who started out with the Full Gospel Businessmen Association. They've had to repackage it. You have the Seventh-day Adventists. They've had to repackage it. You've had the, you have this crowd. They have to repackage it. It's one of those things that you want to look for that is a telltale sign that this is not the real deal. What we believe, I've taught it for 50 years, over 50 years. I've never had to repackage anything. The guys that taught me going back for the last 2,000 years have never repackaged anything. I preach today, and a lot of people don't like it because of the world that we live in. I preach today exactly what the Waldensians preach, the Albigensians preach, going all the way back to Antioch. And it's never, Bible truth has never been repackaged. We never had to come up and rechange our doctrines because of the fact that we were getting our tails kicked because somebody with a Bible was exposing us. And that's what they all do. That's one of the things you want to look for. If it's what I said Sunday, and boy, it was a great, profound thing that I said. It's the fact that truth, there's no variations of truth. Truth doesn't vary it. It's truth is truth. You don't repackage it. You don't change what you believe so it'll fit because it doesn't fit anymore. And this is one of the things that you want to look for. So we'll hold up there. I got through all of them to the guy that asked me about Isaiah 3.